This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books and Biography, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Mark Clovis, your host for the channel. Today, I'm speaking with Samantha Barbas, author of the book, The Rise and Fall of Morris Ernst, Free Speech Renegade. Samantha, welcome to the New Books Network.
Thank you so much for having me. It's such a pleasure.
Well, thank you for agreeing to be on our podcast. I was wondering if you could start us off by telling our listeners something about yourself.
Yes, I am a professor of law at the University of Buffalo School of Law. I have a law degree, and I also have a PhD in U.S. history from the University of California, Berkeley. And I have done research in the fields of U.S. social and cultural history, and also legal history, specializing in media history. I've written on film and gossip journalism. I've written on radio and movie censorship, and I've written on the law of privacy and libel as they affect the mass media. So I've covered a number of episodes in history and a number of interesting personalities in my work, but no one has been more interesting than Morris Ernst, I must say.
I was saying, having read your book, I can see how, you know, Ernst's career touches upon so much of that. What led you to undertake a biography of him?
Yeah, so as I mentioned, I had done a lot of research on media law and media history. I'd written about film censorship, radio regulation, libel cases in, you know, the 1930s and 40s. And I noticed that this man seemed to be everywhere in the field. So Morris Ernst's name was on all of the briefs in the big cases. He had written a number of important books on the subject. He seemed to be, you know, the lawyer in all of these high-profile matters in this field. And so I set out to figure out, who is this guy? You know, what led him to become involved in this work? I soon discovered that Morris Ernst had left an archive of 600 boxes of personal papers to the University of Texas, Austin. And now, I had done archival research in the past, but never had I come across 600 boxes of material. So to me, this posed a definite challenge. So I went down, you know, to begin looking at this collection and discovered that this man was far more important in the history of mass media and free speech than I had ever imagined. And so, you know, I was drawn into his life and his story, and so lucky, you know, to have had the opportunity to write the book and publish it.
One of the things you do in the book that I think is so fascinating is you highlight the contradictions in Ernst's life. Because you, on the surface, you think, you know, here is this person who does so much to shape, you know, the first interpretations of the First Amendment in the 20th century. He does so much to define freedom of speech as we understand it today. And yet you also describe how there are aspects of his life that would seem to run very much counter to that.
Yes, and that was absolutely the most fascinating aspect of Ernst's life and career. You know, he starts out his career as a very classical free speech advocate, promoting viewpoint neutrality, you know, defending freedom for the thought that we hate, defending books that had been banned and films that had been censored. And then he turns into an ardent anti-communist for, you know, a number of reasons that I can explain later on. But he devotes his career in many ways to the suppression of speech and the suppression of individuals who hold views that are contrary to his. And so trying to explain that and make sense of it was a challenge that I faced in the work.
The other aspect of it that I thought was so interesting, though, as I was reading you undertaking that, was how relevant I found it. I mean, on one hand, you're writing about someone who's talking about, free speech battles in the 1920s and 1930s, to questions about, knowledge of contraception, the ability to print profanity in books and so forth. And then you have the anti-communist stuff, and this might seem to be, of another age. And yet, it strikes me in recent years how we've returned to a lot of these questions, is absolute free speech such a good thing? Should there be restrictions on it? And seeing how people who, not too long ago were taking absolutist positions are now beginning to say in a different climate, maybe we shouldn't have so much free speech. And Moritz Ernst seems, his engagement with it seems so relevant in that respect.
Yes. I mean, that is, kind of the question of the 20th century, and even more the 21st century, is how do we, draw lines around protected speech, in a way that protects speech adequately, but still gives protection to other interests, right, like reputation and privacy and safety. And, the line is constantly shifting based on social circumstances and public opinion. And it's not clear that there's really a right place to draw the line. And so we see, Morris really grappling with that question, as many, do today.
I was wondering if you could start us off by telling a bit about his early years. What was his family like, and what were the circumstances that launched him into a career in the law?
So Morris Ernst was born in 1888 in Uniontown, Alabama, which is kind of an unexpected locale. For the birth of a civil liberties leader. Morris Ernst's father, Carl, had immigrated to Alabama from the Czech Republic in the 1850s. And this, again, was very unusual. There were not many Jewish immigrants to Alabama in this time. Morris Ernst's father worked for a while as a pack peddler. And that was someone who put on a big backpack, put in it dry goods such as, thread and flour and other household supplies. And he peddled it to rural families in the community. And through this work, he saved up enough to open a general store in a small town. And then the family moved to New York after Morris was born. And the father was a real estate person, rather successful. They were moderately well off, and Morris began to run in sort of elite circles at the time, a German-Jewish community that was highly educated. Morris's mother had come from that community, and they were part of it in New York. And I think this experience was very formative in shaping Morris's identity. He was friends with people who were very cultured and very sophisticated. And while Morris's own family was affluent, he wasn't at the top of this social circle. And he felt a sense of insecurity. He felt that he needed to find a way to kind of stand out among these very distinguished individuals. And he learned that the thing that he could do that made him a person to be noticed was to be a provocateur. He became an expert at finding ways to draw attention to himself by being controversial, by saying something flamboyant, right, by making a wild assertion. And this really defines his entire career, somebody who's a showman and who's adept at attracting attention. So Morris goes to Williams College. It's a liberal arts college in Western Massachusetts, and he succeeds there. However, anti-Semitism in the professions at the time kind of prevented Morris from getting the kind of job after college that many of his Williams cohorts had been able to attain. So Morris started his career as a manager in a family-owned garment factory in Brooklyn. After a couple of years, he worked as a salesman in a furniture store. Recognizing that these occupations were not going to give him the intellectual satisfaction that he craved, He went to law school, night school, New York Law School, and graduated. Again, the you know, anti-Semitism of the legal profession was quite profound at this time, barred him from entering any type of established law firm in New York. So Morris and a couple of friends who were Jewish law graduates of Columbia University created their own firm called Greenbaum, Wolf, and Ernst. This firm would eventually become very respected and known for its work in the field of literary and media law. But when it started out in 1915, it was just a couple of guys in a nearly empty room, a few beat-up desks. They couldn't even afford to pay a secretary. They were taking any kind of case they could get, you know, car accident cases, criminal cases. And it was a very, very humble beginning. But that is how Morris Ernst, you know, made his way into the field of law.
So we describe how when he's starting out, he has this small firm, and they're really kind of, you know, jacks of all trades. They're doing wills, they're doing, you know, deeds. You mentioned they're sometimes doing accident law and everything. How does he, you know, where does he find this you know, transition? Is it something that has always kind of been there for him, or does he stumble into this career? And what is it that ultimately draws him to defining himself as a free speech crusader?
Yeah, so it's kind of an interesting path. Morris begins going to progressive meetings at night. And when I mean progressive meetings, you know, this was the time of the progressive era, progressivism, referring to the social movement at the time that was trying to curb some of the negative you know, social and economic effects of industrialization. So the progressives fought for minimum wage laws, right? They wanted to end child labor. They wanted to clean up the tenements, so forth. And Morris becomes involved with a number of progressive organizations in New York and kind of makes a name for himself as a rising young activist. And it was through this that he got acquainted with Roger Baldwin. Roger Baldwin was a social reformer who was then creating the American Civil Liberties Union. The ACLU grew out of the World War I era and the intensive government repression of dissent during the war. The ACLU was formed to defend the socialists, pacifists, anarchists, and other dissenters who had been persecuted for their beliefs. And Baldwin, who was a character in his own right, very complicated and, you know, charismatic, ultimately very charismatic man, needed to find people to help him build up the ACLU. And so he called on Morris to help him with money and also to help him with the law. Now, the ACLU in the beginning wasn't a legal advocacy organization, as it later became. Did a lot of direct action work, you know, protests, standing on the streets, you know, calling for free speech. But in the 1920s, it began to turn its attention more and more to the courts as a forum for winning free speech rights. And so, you know, the services of lawyers like Morris became increasingly important to the organization. So Morris gets involved in the ACLU in the 1920s, and I think it's through his affiliation with that group that he begins to really embrace free speech as a cause and an ideal.
One of the things that I thought was fascinating as I was reading your book was this notion of timing, in that you describe how when he goes to law school, it's at a time where these nighttime law schools, the opportunity to become a lawyer, even as you're working full time, becomes a possible. And then how Ernst is there. He's not one of the founders of the ACLU, as you make clear, but he's there early on when they're beginning this. And then there's also this broader climate, which seems to create opportunities where none existed. I was wondering if you could talk perhaps a bit about what that free speech climate was like, because you In your book, you talk a bit about the context, Anthony Comstock, the use of laws to suppress the transmission of ideas through the mails, the use of customs laws. What was the climate of free speech like before you see Ernst's groundbreaking litigation?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's safe to say that things were very repressive as far as freedom of speech goes. I mentioned this intense crackdown on dissent during the war years. There was no such thing as a First Amendment law yet. There was no such thing as a body of free speech jurisprudence. The Supreme Court had not addressed the First Amendment in any significant way, prior to the 1920s. Public opinion was very hostile to the idea of free expression. It was widely thought that those who were different from the majority, those who had unorthodox views, those who were unpatriotic or un-American should not have the right to express their thoughts lest they subvert the social order. And that, held in the realm of politics and political speech and also in the realm of the arts. So as you suggested, there were strict obscenity laws. The Comstock Law of 1873, and all of the states had obscenity laws that were similar, that criminalized selling, publishing, possessing material that was deemed obscene. The reigning definition of obscenity was very, very broad. Something was considered obscene if it had a tendency to corrupt the most vulnerable person into whose hands material may fall, meaning that if a book or a work of art would have the tendency to corrupt a child, that's, outlandish, then it could be declared obscene. So there was not a lot of tolerance for sexually themed material, for anything that kind of contradicted the strict Victorian morals of the time. There was a lot of work to be done, to put it mildly. And the ACLU and Ernst pursued that on many different fronts.
One of the things that he does that you describe in the book, or at least he tries to do, is he tries to invoke the opinions of professionals or the judgments of professionals. And I was thinking especially in terms of the cases that involved, say, contraception and medical practice. And it gives a sense as to how the times are changing, not just in terms of tolerance of free speech, but also in terms of how you're starting to see discussions of these things in ways in which that provide the groundwork for saying, this isn't smut, this isn't obscene, this is, in an age where we're beginning to look at things more scientifically, we're beginning to have a better medical understanding of things, we need to talk about these things in order to convey that knowledge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that was actually Morris's main argument in these cases where he defended banned books or birth control that was deemed to be obscene, or even writings about birth control were condemned as obscene. And Morris's tack was always to talk about public opinion and scientific opinion and expert views to make the argument that these obscenity laws are really old-fashioned. They reflect the 19th century and the kind of puritanical thoughts of that time, and a time that was before modern science. But now people are becoming more enlightened. We're entering an age of greater scientific understanding and greater sexual freedom. In the 20s, women were wearing short skirts, and we have Hollywood films and tabloids. And he would always try to make the point that the law must keep in touch with reality. The law has to be updated to reflect social conditions as they actually exist. And science, in the state of modern science.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Now, you described that as one of his tools when he was arguing his cases. What kind of attorney was he? Did he rely upon a thorough understanding of the law? Was he a bit more of a showman and a dramatist? Did he find new ways of using precedent? How exactly, did he work in the courtroom in terms of his advocacy for his clients?
Yeah, so Morris was extremely non-traditional, to put it mildly. He was, what we would call a legal realist. He would often say, the outcome of legal cases, is dependent on what the judge had for breakfast. Meaning that law was a human endeavor. Cases were decided by judges and juries, and you could argue precedent all day long, but if you hadn't kind of touched the hearts and the minds of the those who were deciding the cases, then you are not likely to win. So some would say that Morris kind of played fast and loose with legal precedent. He wasn't scrupulous in adhering to the formal rules as some of his other legal colleagues were, but his main tactic was to often, kind of turn courtroom proceedings or trials into shows, and he was a great public speaker, and he would bring in props into the courtroom. And sometimes he would try to plant editorials in, newspapers to try to convince, judges that they should rule a certain way in a case. And he was extremely ahead of his time, kind of in his knowledge of the importance of public relations and public opinion in the outcome of cases.
Well, I was wondering if you could perhaps you describe in your book all the major cases in which he established this free speech, this First Amendment jurisprudence. I was wondering if you could perhaps highlight one or two that you think are especially noteworthy or perhaps best representative of what Morris Ernst was doing during this period.
Sure. So I think it's probably most appropriate to talk about the Ulysses case. And that's really kind of Ernst's claim to fame or one of his most notable cases. He defended James Joyce's Ulysses in 1932, and Ulysses was, of course, the most notorious banned book of the time. But just to say a little bit about how Morris got involved in the fight against literary censorship. So I had mentioned the Comstock laws, and those laws were passed in the 19th century, but they were being very actively enforced in the 1920s. There was a group in New York, a private kind of vigilante society called the New York Society for the Suppression of Vice. And this organization had actually been deputized by the state to help it prosecute individuals under the state's obscenity law. So this Vice Society would conduct bookstore raids. They go into stores where allegedly obscene books were being sold. The stores would be raided, all the books would be burned, the bookseller would be jailed. It was a very spectacular and kind of grim situation. So Morris is called on in the 1920s to defend a struggling author whose books had been seized, and Morris goes to court and loses badly. And the loss really makes him angry. He starts to think about the absurdity of this obscenity law that is so vague and that is so repressive. And he sets out to write a book that's basically a condemnation of obscenity law. It's called To the Pure, a Study of Obscenity and the Censor. And this book made him an expert in the field. And then everybody starts asking Morris, to help him defend their books. So by the 1930s, early 30s, Morris had won so many cases in the literary censorship field that he had the confidence to try to liberate, as he called it, the most notorious banned book of the time, and that was Ulysses. So Ulysses was published in 1920 in Paris, and it was almost immediately condemned in the United States as obscene. Nevertheless, people read Ulysses in the U.S. The book was smuggled in, you know, it was wrapped in brown paper covers and treated like contraband. But people read it, and it was highly successful, and it was very well regarded by literary critics. Yeah,
I was thinking about that part in your book where Ernest is trying to establish the groundwork for a case, and he's trying to get customs to seize a book, and they've opened it up, and it's like, oh, we're not going to seize this book. We see so many copies of this coming through as it is.
Yeah, exactly. So Morris decides to have a test case, and it would involve the tariff law, which allowed customs officials to seize obscene books, and he was going to challenge the seizure. He had books sent from Paris, but they wouldn't seize the book for that reason. They said, oh, so many people bring this in. We've just given up trying to stop the entry. And so Morris goes down and says, no, you seize the book. And then they did. And that's how his famous test case began. But the way Morris did this test case, he actually arranged with Bennett Cerf, who was the publisher of Random House, this very shrewd deal. He said to Cerf, you know, work with me to legalize this book. And you don't have to pay me anything, but I want 5% of the royalties if, you know, Ulysses is legalized and you publish it. And of course, the book was cleared and Morris made a lot of money off the publication of Ulysses by Random House. So the test case goes before a judge called John Woolsey, who was a very eccentric judge. He was kind of a literary man. He thought of himself as very well read. And Morris makes the case before Woolsey, again, that obscenity law must be updated to meet the temper of the times, that you know, works must be judged on the basis of community standards. Works must be judged as a whole. In the past, you know, book could be declared obscene on the basis of isolated passages. And Morris makes a very famous argument. It's probably one of the most memorable courtroom arguments of his time, involving the F word. And so that was one of the bases for the books having been declared obscene. It was profanity in the book. And Morris wants to try to convince the judge that there's nothing dirty about that word. It's just arbitrary, you know, four letters in, you know, random order. And Morris says to Judge Woolsey, moreover, you know, this word is cleaner and less revolting than a phrase used every day in every modern novel to describe exactly the same thing. And Judge Woolsey says, and what might that be, Mr. Ernst? And Morris says, they slept together. It means exactly the same thing. And Woolsey said, but counselor, that isn't even usually the truth. So it was in that moment, you know, when Morris knew that he had won the case. But that's, you know, that's very Morris Ernst style, just to do something totally over the top, but he succeeds.
You mentioned this, the shrewd arrangement that he made with Joyce's American publisher to sets him up for life. And it's one of the things that I was really surprised by is that, you know, how not only is he this incredibly, you know, successful free speech attorney, and he has this growing profile, not just in terms of the legal community, but nationally, but he also becomes enormously financially successful. And how this, you know, I thought it was just so fascinating to see how that, because it's something that I thought about as I thought about, you know, his later years and how, you know, the degree to which, you know, did that change him in any way? Or because as you described early on, you know, he wasn't, you know, quite the opponent of communism that he became by, say, the early 1930s, but he is nonetheless, he becomes this national celebrity who writes columns, who produces books, who appears on radio, and he is really you know, notable for that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, his life was successful in so many ways. I mean, as you say, he was wealthy. That had to do in part with his very successful legal practice for his paid clients like, you know, banks and real estate companies. And you know, he was a master of, you know, very technical areas of commercial law. He had a very lavish lifestyle, which again is something you kind of don't associate with someone who was doing public interest work and, you know, fighting for rights. He had this lavish estate in Nantucket, second home, and he would go there for 3 months each year and not do any work. I mean, this was before cell phones and email, and he would just sail and, you know, make furniture, you know, for 3 months without doing any legal employment. And so a phenomenal, you know, lifestyle that he made for himself. But he did, you know, become also a public intellectual, a public figure, especially after Ulysses. He had books. He wrote 21 books in his lifetime, newspaper columns, constantly on the radio. He was sort of the kind of he was like a pundit, like we'd see on CNN today, right? Somebody who was a talking head, you know, and a personality. Just a stunningly successful career.
And you also mentioned an aspect of this that that you later highlight as being significant in terms of this rather unorthodox association, which is that in the 1930s, of course, you're talking about the Great Depression. The Franklin Roosevelt wins the White House in 1932. And it, you know, you had the New Deal, and that, and it's, you know, oftentimes described as, you know, it's the lawyer's New Deal, and you have this massive legal, you know, injection of lawyers into Washington D.C., into federal government, and Ernst, you know, he's, you describe him, he's not at involved in this. He never becomes a judge. He never assumes a position in the federal government, but you describe how he becomes this, you know, maybe kind of like a satellite with Franklin Roosevelt. He's associated with him, and how, you know, and you also describe, and I thought this was especially fascinating, the effect this has a bit on his ego.
Right. So after Ernst's victory in the Ulysses case, he kind of becomes convinced that he could really be a player in politics. And Ernst never runs for office, but he does forge a lot of connections with important figures in the New Deal, administrators, policymakers, and actually Roosevelt himself. Morris starts writing to Roosevelt saying, "Do you need my assistance? You know, you're my idol. Can I help you in some way?" And so Morris does become involved in New Deal politics in a way. He becomes what one journalist called a fixer for Roosevelt. That may be too strong of a term, but he did, you know, help Roosevelt negotiate deals and paper over conflicts, and was involved in various foreign missions. Ernst was good friends with Felix Frankfurter, who's, you know, of course, would be on the Supreme Court, and a number of other well-placed New Deal officials. And it's interesting that Morris himself thought that was his greatest contribution to history, was influencing, you know, the New Deal and Roosevelt's reforms of the 30s. But I don't think anyone else would see it that way. You know, but it really did stoke his ego, as you suggested, you know, to think that he could be associating with these, you know, national officials. It was very gratifying to him.
This is also the point at which you start to see him coming out more prominently against communism. And I was wondering if you could talk about that relationship, because it's an undercurrent throughout much of his early career, this association with communism, which in the 1920s was this, you know, radical, you know, not quite fringe ideology, but it was one in which, you know, Ernst's attitude beginning is a little different than his attitude is in the 1930s. But you have this at a time when communism is being accepted by a lot of people as being, you know, the alternatives being either, you know, democracy has failed, capitalism has failed, it's either fascism or communism. You have a lot of people gravitating towards communism. And yet early on during this period, Ernst is beginning to take a more strident opposition to it. Why does he do this, and how does this fit with his advocacy for free speech?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Great question. So as you point out, the 1930s was a time when the Communist Party was gaining a great popular membership in the United States, because of course this was a time of economic crisis and many Americans became quite skeptical of capitalism and the status quo, and communists were offering an ideology that seemed hopeful. You know, communists were organizing labor unions and directly addressing the circumstances of the Great Depression. Many liberals became involved in communist-affiliated groups of the time, and some of those individuals were involved in organizations that Ernst held dear, like the ACLU, of course, and also the National Lawyers Guild. This was an association of progressive lawyers that Ernst founded in 1937 to help promote the New Deal. Ernst was very upset at the presence of these communist-affiliated individuals in these groups. He felt that they were breaking apart the groups, creating factions, that they were subverting liberal groups to potentially anti-democratic purposes, that they were tainting the public image of these groups. It was very bad, you know, for the ACLU to be publicly associated with communism. It was a definite liability, you know, at a time when the House Un-American Activities Committee was getting started and, you know, see the beginnings of an anti-communist witch hunt. But most of all, Morris was upset because many of these radicals, as he called them, were challenging his authority and his leadership of these groups. And he comes to feel that these groups must be purged of their communist members. And he sets out to do exactly that in some, you know, actions that were quite questionable in the late 1930s.
And this leads to this fascinating association with J. Edgar Hoover. And that's one that continues in Ernst's mind, clearly, for the rest of his life. But as you described, it's really over the next couple of decades. What does Ernst see in Hoover, and how does he make himself available to Hoover, and how does Hoover utilize him in this anti-communist fight?
Yeah, this is such a bizarre story. But again, you know, it's kind of classic Morris Ernst. Morris got acquainted with Hoover, I think, in 1938. They met through mutual social connection. And Morris becomes basically duped. He's duped by Hoover. He is convinced that Hoover is a great crusader against communism, and that the FBI is really this professional and progressive law enforcement organization that does not violate anyone's civil rights or civil liberties. And the FBI, he believes, must be protected against criticism at all costs. So Morris takes it upon himself to become kind of an informal public relations agent for the FBI. He writes positive articles about the FBI for the press. He has a lot of connections in the media, so he's able to find out whenever a negative piece about the FBI is coming out. He'll try to quash that article. It's sort of ironic for someone who devoted himself to fighting against censorship. Here he's trying to censor articles that are unfavorable towards the FBI. He often would advise Hoover on how to respond to critical commentary in the press. Perhaps, most tragically, Morris becomes a sort of spy within the ACLU for the FBI. He would alert Hoover as to when members of the ACLU were planning to criticize the FBI. He would forward to Hoover minutes of ACLU board meetings and correspondence with his ACLU colleagues. And this was such a terrible betrayal of the group that he had helped to build up and his colleagues and friends. Why he did that, I mean, obviously he was totally immersed in the anti-communist crusade, but I think there was also a way in which Morris idolized Hoover in the same way that he idolized Roosevelt, you know, and almost kind of just lost his mind. You know, he would send these letters to Hoover saying literally, like, I love you, you know, what can I do to help you? You are the great protector of democracy. It's really kind of fawning and kind of uncomfortable to read, but, you know, just in this, you know, adulation. And that lasted, you know, until the late 1950s, when actually Hoover cut off Ernst. Morris had done a lot of questionable things that were covered heavily in the media. And I think Hoover decided that having Ernst connected to him was actually a liability.
I thought it was interesting when you talk about Ernst's involvement with the Rosenberg case, because I thought it spoke to how Ernst saw his relationship with Hoover, how he saw thought that it showed how sincerely he believed that Hoover was about, you know, the Constitution and defending these things. And well, if that is true, then by extension, and you feel that the Rosenbergs have been unfairly treated, then by extension, Hoover should be on their side. And of course, that was exactly the opposite of Hoover's attitude on the case.
Yeah, Morris, on his own accord, tries to get on the Rosenberg's defense team for the purpose of collecting information to give to Hoover. That never happened. You know, his efforts to get involved were rejected. But it's a shocking thing, you know, to think that Morris had, you know, gone so far as to, you know, be able to square this with his conscience.
So, By this point, in your book, you're talking about this. You give the impression that, you know, at this point, a lot of what Ernst has done in terms of his legal achievements are increasingly behind him. Mm-hmm. And but it's more than just the fact that, you know, he's established his jurisprudence and he's shaped the law and that's done. You start to talk about how his attitude evolves, especially when you get into the 1960s. And you start to see a lot of social changes there taking place. In effect, a lot of the speech environment that Ernst has helped to foster now leads to things that cause him to shift his opinions.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the latter part of Morris's career, I would say from the 1940s on, it's more or less, you know, a story of decline. He becomes immersed in his work for Hoover and is also his work for Roosevelt for some period of time and doesn't pay as much attention to his civil liberties efforts. He's more concerned with being a pundit and, you know, an advisor to powerful figures. In the 1950s, he does a number of things to, cause him to fall out of favor with his liberal colleagues. At one point, as I describe in the book, he represented a Dominican dictator solely, it appears, in a bid to gain publicity for himself because he knew he was fading from the spotlight, right? He was not being called on to, you know, represent high-profile cases or to offer his opinions. He was becoming a relic, and this disturbed him. So he engaged in a lot of questionable activities. By 1960, and now Ernst is, you know, in his 70s, he had simply, you know, passed from the public sphere, and he retires to his estate in Nantucket. His wife dies. That was a very significant loss for him. He becomes bitter and depressed, I think it's safe to say, and begins to question some of the accomplishments of his earlier career. And as you mentioned, you know, at one point he wonders if the sexual freedom that he had fought for had really gone too far. And so now we're in the 60s and it's the hippie era. And, you know, it's interesting. I guess people generally grow more morally conservative the older they get. but he also comes to believe that, freedom requires a certain amount of privacy. In other words, you know, particularly in sexual affairs, right? That it wasn't necessarily a good thing if everyone was, you know, disclosing everything, kind of letting it all hang out. That there was a certain amount of reticence that was necessary for dignity in personhood, and that the, you know, things had gotten a bit out of control. He never actually called for government censorship. Even in his final years, he believe that society should self-police and the media should self-police. He thought that TV stations should not show nudity, for example, you know, that they should exercise self-restraint to help keep the culture civilized. So he did turn a little bit in his final decade.
That was the part of your book I thought was most surprising, is how he seems to basically, it's like he was beginning to conclude maybe there is such a thing as too much freedom of the press. And you're right, he never sat there and said, I made a mistake by doing all this. There is this sense that he was beginning to appreciate that maybe some sort of control was needed, albeit self-control mm-hmm. rather than, imposed control.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What do you think is Ernst's legacy in that respect? I mean, can we look at him just in terms of free speech, or is it more complicated by stands like that and his association with Hoover?
Yeah, I think there are many lessons to be learned from Ernst's life. I think he left behind a very complicated legacy. I mean, first and foremost, I think, Morris Ernst's great influence was on the law of free speech. Between 1920 and 1950, there was really a free speech revolution in the United States. In 1920, there was no free speech law, no First Amendment law at the Supreme Court. By the 1950s, the Supreme Court has developed an entire structure of the First Amendment, adopting many of the principles that Ernst and the ACLU had promoted, like viewpoint neutrality, like no prior restraints or gag laws. A more limited definition of obscenity, broad freedoms for political speech. The censorship of literature had almost completely declined by the 1950s. The Vice Society actually shut its doors in 1947. So in that sense, Morris Ernst's influence is truly profound. Ernst also really turned the ACLU into a mainstream organization when it started in 1920. The ACLU was totally considered a bunch of subversives, it was a fringe group. They were reviled, they were called free speech fakers. They were as hated as the people they defended. And then by 1945, when the ACLU had its 25th anniversary, the event was actually held at a fancy New York hotel. And Truman sent a telegram of congratulations. And Arthur Garfield Hayes, who was one of the lawyers, main lawyers, said, in the old days, we used to go down in the coal fields and hold protests and try to get ourselves arrested. And now we file briefs and, governors speak at our dinners. So the whole group had become socially accepted, and the principles they stood for had become increasingly accepted. And I think Morris had a lot to do with that. And he was a prosperous lawyer. He was educated. He was respectable. And he helped transform the image of the ACLU. He also brought the ACLU's interests into the New Deal through his connections with, officials in the Roosevelt administration. But, I think even beyond that, kind of have a classic story of somebody who wanted power, attained it, and was ultimately corrupted by it and misled by it. And that led to his downfall. It's, the classic story, but you see it kind of played out so very painfully in Ernst's saga.
Well, we've taken up a lot of your time, but before we go, could you tell us what you're working on now?
Yeah, so I have just finished another book on a famous Supreme Court case from 1964 called New York Times versus Sullivan. And this was a First Amendment case that dealt with libel law and ultimately placed limits on the ability of public officials to sue their critics for libel and recover damages. It became of a landmark case that is also potentially coming under criticism, and there's some talk that the Supreme Court may revisit and overrule this case. So I've been very interested in it.
Well, I hope that when the book is published, we can have you back on the New Books Network to talk about it.
That would be wonderful.
Well, Samantha Barbas, thank you very much for taking some time out of your schedule to speak with us. I hope you have a wonderful day.
Thank you. You too.